What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today we have another Q&A episode, so thank you to everybody who asked a question. I am sitting outside on my little patio on a nice December day. It's actually beautiful out right now. I thought, you know, this would be, I'll do a nice podcast when Emerson goes down, put her down for a nap. And of course, for the avid listener, you know that my office and studio is adjacent to the nursery. So the minute she goes down, I'm like, oh yeah, I can't record there. So I whip out the little USB mic. We go outside, and honestly, it's really nice out here. The audio might be a little bit less good, so I do apologize for that. My editor, James, I love you, dude. Thank you for making these audible, listenable, and so I really do appreciate that. So we are going to kick things off with a question. I have a feeling I know who asked this one. A good question here. The question reads, if lifting is a learning curve and we get better at recognizing RIR and improving form over time, why is it that gains slow down? Shouldn't it be the opposite? So this, basically what this person's asking, hi Tammy, good question, is that if we get better at lifting over time, which is true and I'll explain how that happens, if we get better at lifting over time, how come gains slow down? Shouldn't we be getting more benefit from something that we get better at? And so there are three things that are true, and we'll kind of talk about them, and then we will talk about what is the net effect of all three of those things combined. And so the first one is that as you lift weights, as you do anything, right, as you do any skill, specifically something that requires coordination, and we'll keep it in very specifically in the context of lifting, the more you lift, the longer you lift, the more years you do it, the more reps you get under your belt, the more hard sets you get under your belt, the more years you get under your belt, the better you get at extracting a quality stimulus from that set. One of the primary adaptations we get is we actually, we improve our coordination, our ability to maintain good technique really close to failure. We also improve what's called neural drive, which is our just basically you can think of it as your mental ability to push hard. And so as you train more, you are better at getting more stimulus from a single set than you used to be. I think of my ability to take an RDL really, really close to technical failure or, you know, maintain technique really deep, close, very close to failure. But when I first started RDLing, the minute it got hard, my technique would break down. I just didn't have those patterns ingrained. I didn't have that coordination, that ability to work close to failure. I also didn't have that neural drive, that understanding of, I didn't, and we all didn't have this idea of, how much pain actually means I need to stop. And I think of this a lot with running. Every time I do a race, a 5K, a 1 mile, 800 meter, every time I do that, I experience a level of pain that I didn't know I could withstand. And so what's happening there is I'm learning exactly how much pain I can handle and what it really means to get to the point where I need to stop. And the same thing happens with lifting, where you realize, I don't need to give up when I start to feel a little bit of pain. But you probably did do that early on. So it is true that the longer you train, the more experience you gain, the more stimulus per set you can achieve, right? And so if you just said that and that was the end of the sentence, then it would be true that you'd have to do less sets, right? I get more from each set, I'd have to do less sets. However, there are two other things happening at the same time. The second thing that's happening is as you gain an adaptation from a stimulus in the body, the minimum effective dose to get better at that thing goes up. And I like using the caffeine analogy, right? So it's like the more you drink caffeine, the more caffeine you'll need to elicit that same response. So if you were like, hey, if you take 100 milligrams of caffeine for a while, it stops hitting the same way. You need a little bit more, then you need a little bit more. The minimum effective dose to gain an adaptation will go up. And what that means is the least amount of training that you can do and still make gains does go up over the lifespan. Maybe there's a uniqueness to the newbie phase, but the minimum effective dose that you need to do goes up. So the first thing we said is that your volume probably goes down because you get better at getting more stimulus per set. But the amount of stimulus you need to elicit any gains at all goes up over time, right? The more muscle you gain, the amount of stimulus that is required to gain more muscle goes up. However, there's a third piece. The third piece is the stronger you get, the more fatiguing each set is. So the maximum amount of work that you can recover from actually goes down, right? Because I'm, you know, when I, if you look at a workout I used to do, maybe I could have done 20 working sets in a workout. Well, it's because those 20 working sets weren't as stimulative and they weren't, well, they were stimulative because I was a newbie, but I wasn't actually extracting as much stimulus from a getting myself really, really close to failure, pushing deep into failure with good technique, maybe into partials. And so we have your minimum effective dose goes up. Your maximum amount that you could recover from goes down because as you get stronger, everything is more fatiguing. It's not the same. So if you're really strong, let's say you've been lifting for 10 years, you do three sets of heavy squats. The amount of fatigue that you will incur because you're lifting a lot more weight than you used to is more than if you have, you know, Susie who's doing squats for the first time ever. She's lifting very little weight. And so you might say, well, it's relatively equally hard for Susie who's squatting the bar as it is for, you know, Sam who's squatting 500 pounds. If they're both doing what they can do in terms of their maximum, wouldn't they both be equally tired? And that is not true. The more weight that you're lifting is an independent thing that increases fatigue per set. So we have these three things that are happening. One is that you are more skilled and more able to extract more stimulus per set. So you would think that your volume requirements go down. Simultaneously over the training career, your minimum effective dose is going up because you're getting more muscle. And so it just takes a little bit more if you want to gain a little bit more muscle. And again, simultaneously, the max that you could do is coming down because you are getting so much from each set, which means you're also getting more fatigued because you're also lifting more weight over time. And so the net of those three things, pretty conveniently, is that the amount of volume you need to grow over your training career stays relatively static because the ceiling comes down, the floor comes up a little bit, and the amount that you can extract from each set goes up. And so the net of those three things is that, you know, after like 3 to 5 years of hard lifting, over the first, let's say 3 years, you might need to do a little bit more. I mean, we see people, I'm not going to do this whole podcast. I did this podcast with Brian Borstein, basically volume changes over the training career. But what happens is when you're a brand new beginner, you don't need to do very much. We put sedentary people on a treadmill, right? And they walk and we see leg hypertrophy. So it is true that in the beginning, you can grow from a uniquely low amount of stimulus, but that does go up. But it's going up as you're getting better at lifting. And so the amount you actually need to do flatlines because you are, yeah, you need to do more for a little while, but you're also getting better at it at the same time. So it seems that it tends to flatline once you're in that intermediate phase. Let's say after the first, you know, 2 years of really hard training, it's unlikely that you need to do any more volume than you are doing at that moment. And we have a whole bunch of research now that shows you don't need to do all that much volume at all if you train really hard with good exercises, even in trained individuals. So pretty cool stuff. Great question. Really, really happy to kick things off with that. We'll do as many as we can in, I don't know, what time is it here? 12:50? Until Emerson wakes up, maybe another half hour. We'll see. Next question. Really struggling with weight gain after having my son in May. How does Jenna push past the change in her body and embrace the season? I hate my picture being taken. First of all, I would ask her, and I'll speak a little bit for her, and say that she struggles too. I mean, she struggles a lot. You know, both of us have been way more fit than we are now, and I would say, you know, she's had to go through a lot more of a transformation between, you know, getting pregnant, having a baby, breastfeeding. So she absolutely struggles. So I'll start by saying, you know, I think Jenna, if she was sitting here and wouldn't put any words in her mouth that I didn't feel comfortable doing, she'd say she's the heaviest she's ever been in her entire life. And she's self-conscious about it. But there are more important things right now, like getting healthy again. Well, I say getting healthy again. What I mean is getting back to exercising, right? I mean, she took like 11 months off. Pregnancy was crazy for her. She had really rough symptoms and she didn't lift for like 8 months. And then she probably didn't lift for at least two months of Emerson's life. So for her, breastfeeding, for which being in a big calorie deficit is probably not a good idea. Being in a small deficit, it seems might not matter. But from what we've learned in terms of breastfeeding, it's the like heterogeneity, meaning like the difference in individuals and how people respond or produce milk is crazy. And so, yeah, you know, some people you know, I've had clients who are breastfeeding and they went into a small deficit and, you know, they decided that they wanted to do this. I said, hey, you might see some supply go down. We decided together that that was something that they were prepared to deal with, and nothing happened. And they was totally fine. They were able to breastfeed. I've had other people say, hey, last time I did that, I tried to deficit, my supply went down, it wasn't worth it. So I think if Jenna were sitting here, she'd say, hey, I am self-conscious, I am struggling, but it's just not the most important thing right now. And, you know, feeding Emerson and getting her lifts in and feeling strong and gaining fitness for her is the most important thing right now. So that's what she's prioritizing. I know that she does have plans to do a little bit of a cut at some point once she feels comfortable that the potential drop in supply is something that she's ready to handle. You know, and so I might just echo a lot of that of like, hey, this is a season of life where you make trade-offs for your family. And again, I don't want to do the easy, it's easy for me to say, I'm a man, I don't have to make those sacrifices, but just watching Jenna go through it, I'm super very sympathetic to those sacrifices, and they're beautiful. They're certainly like a get to, not have to scenario. Like, we're very blessed to be able to have those problems. I think a lot about, I mean, I hate to do this to you and I hate to pull this card, but I think a lot about what 90-year-old you will say. I sit with that quite often. I think about what I would tell my daughter if she were in this situation. I think about what I would tell a best friend if he or she were in this situation. And I just think that one of those three questions, or all three of them combined, will tell you exactly the right advice, the best advice, the most mentally healthy advice for you. It's just about whether or not you think you deserve that advice. Because the truth is, if I ask you right now, question asker, you know, what would 90-year-old you say? I guarantee you, you give me a wonderfully compassionate, balanced answer. The question is, do you think you are worthy of that advice? Next question. Where is it easiest to see muscle growth the fastest, upper or lower, and why? How do I want to answer this? The grass grows wherever you water it. There's some, you know, a bit of research on things like the calves that maybe are very low, very slow twitch muscle dominant that tend to maybe grow a little bit slower. I think men tend to have a greater proportion of their muscle mass on their upper body on average, but that's a starting point. That's not a reflection of how easy it is to grow there. Women have a greater proportion of their muscle at baseline on average in their lower body, but again, not a reflection of ease of growing it. I would say genetically, there's a huge, again, heterogeneity, meaning differences between individuals from a gene perspective that make this question really tough to answer. You know, you know that person who's like, yeah, I just worked my glutes a little bit and they blew up. And then you know the other person who's, I've been working my glutes for years and they don't grow. And so I think that there's a big heterogeneity here. I think, you know, you'll see a big wide spectrum of people's experiences with how easily it was to grow X muscle. I don't think I would speak to a large generalization here. Next question. Favorite Christmas movie? Die Hard? Harry Potter? I'm not... First of all, I'm Jewish. So let's get that one out there. Honestly, Jenna's made me watch so many Christmas movies. I mean, Home Alone is decent. I'm really like wiping my head right now. Home Alone is decent, I guess. Elf is a great movie, but, you know, by the 8 trillionth time you've watched Elf, you're kind of like, okay, you know, this was funny until it became something I watch 80 times a season, and Jenna would slap me if she heard me say that, because we've, you know, it's probably been on in my house 10 times since Thanksgiving. So, next question. Last meal request before you die. Oh, jeez, harsh. Yeah, it depends how many courses I get. I mean, this is always a tough one. I think if you ask me knee jerk, I have some sort of pasta, some sort of good, beautiful bread with olive oil. If you made me pick a protein, I'd probably pick a steak. Yeah, maybe a steak with, I mean, I know that meal doesn't necessarily go together, but like, hey, we're trying to get in as much as we can before we go here. So, definitely a pasta dish. What kind of pasta would I want? I'd go with a red sauce. You know, I just wouldn't risk that my last meal being like something out of the ordinary. So I'd go for something simple. Like, if, you know, maybe I'd go for a spicy red sauce, a fra diavolo or something. You know, if you go something, you know, out there, you're, you know, a carbonara or something, you know, maybe a cacio e pepe. Yeah, if I could get a good cacio e pepe, we could call it after that. I'll tell you right now, there wouldn't be a vegetable in sight. That's for damn sure. Next question. Are these questions real? Yeah, they are real. Sometimes this app gives you questions, right? They like the app itself asks you questions, and they're always kind of like, are you single? Or like, who are you talking to? It's supposed to like just be like something that stirs up. This question, were Ross and Rachel on a break? 100% on a break. Moving on. What does one-on-one coaching look like with you? Do you have any openings? So I just sent an email blast out that I'll be taking some clients in the new year, and I have it on my to-do list to go through those applications this week and start scheduling. I really don't love overloading the onboarding process. I mean, maximum one client per week. Frankly, if I could have it my way, it'd be every other week, but you know, I don't want to make people wait until May or something, you know? So I'll probably be taking one new client a week for maybe the first 8 weeks of the new year. And so I'll be going through the applications and sending emails out. What does one-on-one coaching look like to me? I actually have a podcast that goes through that. God, it's in the first 50 episodes years ago. But frankly, the way I do my one-on-one coaching is still almost identical. Some things have changed. Some systems have been optimized, but for the most part, it's very similar. A brief overview. I don't want to spend too much time on this. This isn't a marketing for my one-on-one here, but is for the first 4 weeks, we do weekly Zoom calls and daily text messages. And it is a lot of get to know you. I mean, it is a lot of getting the train on the tracks, plugging me into your life, me getting to know you, what your problems are, you know, what sorts of things we want to work on. After that first month, we go to monthly Zoom calls and a weekly check-in, which is a check-in form that you fill out. Then I send you a screen recording of myself going over everything. And all of my clients have my personal phone number. We text, you know, all the time, whether it's form videos or food questions or training questions or I'm having a rough day, whatever it is, all my clients have my personal number. And frankly, to this day, nobody has abused that. And I think that there's a lot of people like business coaches, like don't give your personal, like maintain boundaries. Like, I don't know. It's just never been, it didn't feel right. It doesn't feel right to me. I feel like, listen, it's not like I'm going to answer at midnight, right? I promise people I answer within 24 hours. And I answer as often as I can, but that's something I offer. I think that there's moments where you need somebody in your corner. You need to not wait fucking 1 to 2, 3 weeks or something to talk to your coach. And so I really hate that. So yeah, all my clients have my personal number. Next question. In survival mode at the moment, life and all the things are crazy. What is the minimum days sets to maintain muscle until things get better? Yeah, so I'll point to two recent studies, and then I will point you to the muscle maintenance. So I think the title is The Science of Muscle Memory, or How Fast Do You Lose Muscle? I think it's like 5 episodes ago. So if you're listening to this, go back. It is that episode about muscle loss, muscle regain. And the third question is what you're asking, which is how little you need to do and still maintain. I think should be required listening for everyone. That podcast is going to give people so much peace of mind. I mean, people are worried about missing a workout, taking a weekend off, taking a week off, taking 2 weeks off to go to Europe. Listen to that podcast. I promise you, it will change your perspective on taking time off. Now, to answer your question directly, I'll point you in the direction of two papers that have come out recently. The first one is one I'll be posting about next week. I think it's by Herman and colleagues. I think Brad Schoenfeld's on this paper, Dr. Pack, Milo Wolf. Basically, they took 40 resistance trained people and they both trained 2 times a week, 30 minutes. So everybody did the same lifting protocol. One group trained every set to failure. The other group trained every set to 2 reps in reserve. They both did 2 times a week, 30 minutes for 8 weeks. And they both groups grew muscle. So when you said, what is the minimum amount of days or sets to maintain muscle until things get better? I would point to that and say, 2 times a week, 30 minutes, if you train to failure or very close, is probably more than you need to maintain for at least 8 weeks, let's say, right? I think the limitation of that study is you have to say, we don't know what would happen if you kept doing that for 6 months, but 8 weeks of 1 hour total of training, if you train hard, close to failure, they grew muscle in 8 weeks. Then I would point to the Pelland meta-regression. And they concluded that the minimum effective or the minimum amount you need to grow muscle, again, not maintain, to grow muscle is 4 fractional sets per muscle group per week. And I'll save you the math on that. That's probably about 60 to 90 minutes of training per week. So for a lot of you, that's less than you're currently doing. I would say 2 times a week, 30 minutes is, for a lot of people, indefinitely would maintain muscle, and for some people would grow muscle. I mean, these people were relatively resistance trained and they still grew muscle in 8 weeks of 2 times a week, 30 minutes. So, and I say 2 times a week, 30 minutes. I know you said sets, right? But like, just say, hey, a very productive 30 minutes of training, you know, they did 18 total working sets per week for the whole body. They did 9 working sets, 1 set each on Monday, and 9 working sets, 1 set each, I think, on Thursday. And that was it. That's it. They did 18 total working sets for the whole body, the whole week. And they did that in 2 times a week, 30 minutes. So yeah, that both of those, what I just said, 4 fractional sets per muscle group per week and 2 times a week, 30 minutes, were shown to cause growth. So that's more than the answer to the question that you're asking, which is just maintain. What does the evidence support about creatine and its benefits? What dose should I use and when? I would summarize this incredibly simply. Creatine helps you train a little bit harder. And if you take creatine's benefit and you actually work a little bit harder, you can grow muscle a little bit faster. In the scheme of things, when we talk about what helps you grow muscle, the training stimulus, training hard, training with enough volume, getting enough sleep, calories, protein, those are by far like a million times more important. When we talk about creatine, we're talking about like a fraction of a percent of the rate of muscle growth. That said, it doesn't cost very much. It doesn't taste like anything. It doesn't cost you a lot of habit change, and it doesn't cost you a lot of money. And so it's almost like a free additional benefit. I know it's not actually free. Additionally, I will say that while the evidence is unclear in healthy young individuals, there is some research in older individuals that creatine improves cognition. I think it was short-term memory recall in people older than 65. And it does that because your brain is one of the biggest utilizers of creatine. And so it would make sense that there's probably something going on cognitively. There's also some research on cognition after poor sleep. And so it seems that creatine can mitigate some of the negative effects of sleeping like shit. I don't know how long creatine would kind of mask those effects, but the deal with creatine is it's not a game breaker. Honestly, it changes what I just said, let's say cognition and strength, so little that I don't think you'll even notice. It's like a multivitamin. You take it and you just kind of trust that it's doing something. But if somebody says, hey, Jordan, when I take creatine, I get X response that I don't like. Maybe it's, oh, I feel like I lose hair loss, which, by the way, there's no research on that. But if, again, I'm not trying to poo-poo people who have those experiences. What I'm saying to you is if you say, you know what, I take creatine and I feel X negative response, and you genuinely think it is creatine doing that, and you stop the creatine, you feel better, those symptoms go away, you're not missing out on freaking anything. Just don't take the creatine. It's no big deal. I'd say if you're a vegetarian or a vegan, you are likely getting less creatine from your diet, so maybe there's more of a benefit to supplementation. And that is because creatine is found in animal proteins. Next question. Do you have any tips on how to overcome severe binge eating disorders? Any coping strategies? I'm already working with a therapist, have been for months now, but nothing has changed. Yeah, I would defer in this context. I think that there's a blurry line between binge eating disorder and disordered eating habits. And again, I think that if you listen to that sentence and you're like, well, that's vague, it is. It certainly is. And there have been times where I've had to refer out. I've had a client. It's like, all right, I think I can help this person, but at some point it is out of my scope. And so you're already doing the thing that I would recommend. I would say that after, you know, my gut says that for a lot of people in this context that, you know, at a certain point, you might want to question if the person you're working with is the right person for you. Like, are you really resonating with are you guys on a path where you can see improvement at all? If not, it might not be the right person, you know, but then again, you know, there's some responsibility on you. It's not just, if you're not seeing benefits, it's the therapist's fault. That's not the case, but it's at least a question I would ask is, do I feel like this is the right person? So I wish you the best. It's not something that I would speak to, seeing as though it's just a clinical scenario that's outside my scope. What do you recommend to improve range of motion for a knee with the current stats, flexion 95, extension 5? So I know the question you're asking. This is a physical therapist question. This is absolutely a question for a physical therapist. I mean, the answer lies somewhere in gradual exposure to greater range of motions under greater loads, strengthening of the surrounding muscles. But the actual systematic implementation of what you would do to achieve those things, I think, is something you should work closely with a physical therapist on. Sorry for the last two being a bit out of scope. Next question. Ever use the Atlantis chest incline chest press? I feel like the line of pull doesn't go upwards for the upper chest. It seems like it goes straight out. What are your thoughts? Well, I'm on my laptop, so I'm going to look this up. Atlantis incline chest press. I have not used this before. Let's see if we can find a picture of this. And you're saying, I feel like the line of pull doesn't go upwards for the upper chest. Seems like it goes straight out. I'm looking at it right now. I'm not looking necessarily at a video of somebody using it, but I can just imagine what the arc of motion is. It does feel like it doesn't necessarily go straight up. And so you might be looking at something that's just, you know, has a slight imperfection. I think if you use the narrower of the two grips, you can at least bias the clavicular head a little bit more with a little bit more elbow tuck. But, you know, maybe you just take it for what it is, and maybe it's a little bit more, you know, sternal, maybe more sternal clavicular mix. And I think you just kind of live with that, right? You enjoy the stability. It looks like the arms are converging. So it does have a lot of things going for it. And you might just say, you know what, the arm path isn't perfect. The angle in terms of which head of the which division of the chest is being biased the most, maybe it's not perfect for clavicular head, for the upper chest, but maybe it works well for other areas of the chest. How do I know when range of motion has dropped off too much with lifts like pull downs versus seated rows? Example, pull downs initially hit the chest, but then don't quite hit as reps progress at the end of the rep range. The answer is it is you need to understand that the further you let range of motion drop off, the more stimulus and fatigue you're getting per set. And you just have to bake that in two things. One, you have to just understand if you're going to push into partial reps, if you're going to let range of motion drop off, that's a very stimulative set, but also fatiguing. So you just have to bake that into the overall programming. Maybe you're not doing as many sets of that. But the most important thing is you don't know, because there's no inherent advice. It's about what the programming calls for. So if I'm coaching this, I will say, I quite like to do what's called forced progression. So something like in week one of your program, every rep of your pull down must hit the chest. When you can't hit the chest, you're done. But every week after that, you either add 5 pounds or you add an extra rep and you let the range of motion fall off naturally. Now, what I just said is not, right? So over time, the weight's going to get heavier and you will find that you won't be able to pull all the way to your chest. And what I just said is not a physiologic, it's not because what I just said is physiologically optimal. It's because what I just said is, from a diagnostics and an application perspective, very easy to understand. Hey, you do 100 pounds and you stop the set when you can't touch your chest. Next week, you're going to do 105 pounds and you're going to match reps no matter what happens to the range of motion. The week after that, 110 pounds, match reps, doesn't matter what happens to the range of motion. So the question is, what is programmed? So this is a situation where you should ask your coach, if there is no description as to when to end the set, right? If it's not like, hey, failure is when you can no longer do X. What I would do is I would start with making sure my first, again, I'm laughing as I'm saying this because I do really like that forced progression. I would say when you can no longer pull below the chin or the mouth or the nose, and that might be something that you decide for yourself, what feels right. You might really, really get a lot out of those last few reps where you pull down to the chin or to the mouth or to the nose or to your eyes or to the forehead. And so the answer is there is no inherent, you should stop when X happens. It's about your program telling you based on what the program's trying to get out of it. So I quite like to do two sets of this because I think in two sets, With forced progression into partial reps, we are getting so much stimulus that two sets is more than enough. And so I like leaning into the fact that you can comfortably work into partials here. So I will rarely say that you should never do reps beyond the point which you should touch your chest or could touch your chest. I think you're missing out on some gains if you never push into partials here. But like you said, where do I draw the line? And so it's about your program giving you that information. But if your program is not giving you that information, you can pick for yourself. You can say, you know what, I'm gonna stop when the reps don't go below the chin anymore. And I think sometimes intuitively you can feel when the reps have lost productivity. You know, you might feel mentally disengaged. And so you can make that call for yourself if your program doesn't say so. And if you happen to be in my program, I don't think I've left that information out. But if so, you know, shoot me a message. We'll get more specific. Next question. Been jumping between fat loss and maintenance for a while, and I want to build. How long should I be in a build? There's so much going on right now with this right now. If you're a big nerd in the hypertrophy space, there's all this like discussion about bulking and cutting being dead. And, you know, you just need this very like tiny micro surplus, just enough to maximize muscle growth and not a calorie more. I'll answer your question directly without getting derailed, because I do have plans to do a more robust, discussion on calorie surpluses. The how long you should be in a surplus, the one line answer is until you feel so fat that you want to stop and you turn around, you want to turn around. And I say it that way a little tongue in cheek, because there is no like length of time. There's not like, oh, at this many months, that's when the magic happens. Or, you know, there muscle growth, energy is fluxing in and out all the time, you know? So there is not like, there's not like a checkpoint, oh, after this many months and then I will start getting muscle. My advice to people when they're thinking about doing a bulk, when they're thinking about doing a calorie surplus, when they're thinking about eating a little bit more to build muscle, whatever terminology you want to use, is buckle up for about 6 months. I mean, if you think you're going to, if you have a plan to do one bout of the pursuit of more muscle, meaning one sustained period of time where you're trying to build muscle, and then your plan is on the back of that to cut and see that you've built muscle. Let's say that's your plan. I would say at least 6 months of trying to build some muscle to have built any amount of muscle that would be ultimately visible after a loss of fat. At least 6 months. Now, truthfully, if you wanted to pick apart that advice, you could say, well, what if I do it for 3 months and then I cut for a month and then another 3 months and then I cut for a month? Is that different than doing 6 months and then cutting for 2 months? I don't think it is different. The only difference between those two things is if you can mentally flip-flop successfully between those two things. A lot of people might find that they find a bit more continuity to be helpful, right? So it's like, hey, by the eighth week, I was really starting to get into the surplus calories, the calories that I really needed to build muscle. I got my food in check, I got my meals in check, and then bang, right away, it's time to cut again. So if you feel like you benefit from the continuity of doing one thing for a bit longer without having to flip-flop a bit more frequently, then you can do it for 6 months at a time. But the truth is, what if someone's like, well, what if I am in a surplus for 2 months and then I spend 2 weeks in a cut and then 2 months and then 2 weeks and then 2 months and 2 weeks, and that all evens out to the same ratio of time of calories over time? Yeah, I can't say that there would be any different results. But I do think if you're thinking about doing one bout of pursuit of muscle growth followed by one bout of pursuit of fat loss, and you expect to see any results of the muscle growth side, I'd buckle up for at least 6 months. Next question. Been seeing a shit ton of ads for this Freak Athlete 9-in-1 Nordic thing. Yes, I am familiar with it. That's so funny. Yes, it's like this Nordic ham curl thing that has like a bunch. It has like 8 different things in one. So I guess that's 9 different things, 9-in-1. I just want to see how much it costs real quick, because I think it's a Freak Athlete 9-in-1 Nordic. Let's see what it costs, because that's ultimately what matters, is the opportunity cost here. And so it says 9 machines in one. I'm going to see if I can find the machines. So let's see. It's like a 45 degree hip extension. It's so funny that they just like repeat a bunch of, I will tell you now, I wouldn't in a million years buy this. Well, the only real exercises that I would find to be uniquely beneficial here is if this is a really good 45 degree hip extension, and it's a really good leg extension and a really good ham curl. I don't know that to be true, though. I don't know that it's a really good ham curl and a really good leg extension. I haven't seen it in motion. I am skeptical that it's a really good ham curl and a really good leg extension, but if it was a really good hyper, a really good back extension, which again, I'm not sure it is, I can't shake the fact that there's, of the nine things, I would really only be excited about three of them. I think that there's like a huge list of features that they think are important that you're probably paying for that you probably wouldn't use that much, and that would bother me, but it's only $800. I say only $800 because, you know, if you were going to buy a good ham curl, you're probably spending $600, and if you were going to buy a good hip extension, you'd probably spend $500. So if you could get all three of those for $800, I think it would be a decent deal. So I've never used it. I don't have any clients who have it, but my knee jerk is that if you bought it, you'd probably get a lot of good use out of it. But if you were somebody who was a little bit of a stickler for, yeah, I'm looking at the leg extension, like I wouldn't buy this myself because I think that I would rather over many years acquire some better pieces of equipment that I'll use for a long time. This is definitely a more all-in-one piece, but you're sacrificing a little bit of quality of each of those things. I would rather buy a good hip extension and then a year later put some money aside and get a leg extension ham curl combo from a company like Xmark or Titan. And yes, that costs more money, but I might be willing to invest over a 5-year period and have these, you know, multiple pieces of equipment that I really love. But will you get a, it's one of those things where like clients are like, should I buy this? And I'm like, well, from an opportunity cost perspective, you maybe have better options. But if you just snap your fingers and this thing was in your house, yeah, we'd use the shit out of it and you probably would love it. Next question. See, so many people say if you want to get lean enough to see abs, you have to be willing to sacrifice hunger, be moody, low energy, etc. Yet athletes all over from rec league, fewer, to pro perform at high levels with low body fat percentage. What gives? Well, I'll start by saying there's a difference between what it would take for you to get lean versus these people that you're talking about that are already lean. So you probably do need to be hungry. Listen, you know, how hungry and moody and low energy do you need to be? I don't know. But a calorie deficit comes with generally those symptoms in differing amounts, right? So if you're losing weight in a calorie deficit, you absolutely are going to sacrifice some hunger, some energy levels, some, you know, maybe mood. Absolutely. That's different than being at that body fat percentage and being at energy balance. I would say a counter to my argument is that, yeah, just because you get to energy balance, it is entirely possible that at that level of leanness, you still don't feel very good. So it's not true to say that, you know, everything's just fine and dandy and you get to maintenance and you just live this super happy life. I would also say that the people that you're talking about have genetic advantages, myself included. You know, the people you, it's almost like a, it's like a reverse causality. It's like a self-selection process where the people who perform really, feel really great with low levels of body fat are also likely the people that have favorable genes for things like athleticism. So it's almost like backwards where it's not like that, you know, they are already the kind of person who would have both of these advantages. They are, you know, we all have different set points. And so some people are going to feel just fine, pretty lean, you know, and everybody's going to have a level of leanness where at that point they start to not feel very good. But where that point is for everybody is different. You know, we can call it like a lower intervention point. So it's like, I'll tell you, I'm 190 pounds. I've been 178 in my adult life and I've been a 219. And when I was 219, I had been bulking for 2 years, around just before COVID, let's say. I cut all the way down to 178 pounds. I was peeled. And I would say I have favorable genetics in this way where I can be quite lean and feel pretty good. But when I was 178, I felt like dog shit. I felt terrible. My libido was gone. My energy was gone. I was shredded, though. It was cool for some pictures. I've talked about this stuff. Like, I never forget this picture that I took one time. I was the leanest I'd been in my adult life. And I made this stupid plan I got so excited. I've always had bigger legs. And so I've always had, this is not a woe is me sentence, but I'm saying my legs have always been larger than my waist. Pants haven't fit me well. I just have had like larger glutes and upper quads and then a slightly smaller waist. And so it didn't fit in pants. Anyway, at this point, when I was 178, I had lost so much body fat, probably a little bit of muscle too, that I was fitting into like slim fit 30-inch waist. And I bought so many pairs of pants. I was so excited that I could finally fit into those clothes. And I felt so terrible. And so for me, being at that level of leanness, I didn't feel very good. So we're all going to have a lower intervention point where we get to a certain level of leanness that is just fighting our genetics. And a lot of those processes kick on that lead us back to food-seeking behavior and regaining body weight so we feel better. And again, set point is a real thing. I have a podcast on it. If you go to the podcast and you search Set Point, you'll see. I think it's a great podcast that does not, did it like 2 years ago. I don't think it needs a redo at all. And so two main points, two main take homes. There's a difference between how you will feel on the way down in a calorie deficit from how you might feel at energy balance, right? I mean, it is factually true that you'll feel better at energy balance. And so that will mitigate some of the shitty feeling. But it's also true that the people you're talking about, really low body fat athletes are probably also people with really lean intervention points where they can feel really good at that lean body fat percentage. I would also say that, even pro athletes battle with being so lean that it might actually affect their performance. I think it's actually not true. I mean, let's be real. You know this person who's asking this. You know it's true that being leaner and leaner and leaner and leaner doesn't linearly improve performance. If we look at the best athletes in the world, they're not, I mean, some of them are really shredded, right? But they're, a lot of athletes are not like, we're going to say, cover your ears, kids, like dick skin lean. They're not like bodybuilder lean. Think of NBA athletes, think of NFL athletes. Now they're lean. They are. But it is also true that for them, there is such a thing as a level of leanness that negatively impacts performance without a doubt. How far are we in here? I can't even tell. Doesn't even tell me. What did we say time-wise? We'll do three more. Next question. Is volume the most important value for a set? Example, lateral raises, 15 reps at 10 pounds versus 10 reps at 15 pounds. Both have a volume of 150. So is one better than the other if both taken to failure? It's a great question. What you're talking about, I'm going to reframe I'm going to use a different word. I'm going to say tonnage or volume load. So the reps times set time load. So one set of 10 reps of 15 pounds would have a volume load or a tonnage of 150 pounds. And if you flip that, 15 reps at 10 pounds, same tonnage. What I would just say right now is tonnage is irrelevant. I don't want to say is irrelevant because you can make a context in which it is relevant, but it's not something you should ever think about ever. I would rather you think of number of hard sets. So both of those sets were hard and they were both within, let's say, 4 to 30 reps. So I would count them as equally stimulative. They're both hard sets. So it is the number of hard sets. And again, number of hard sets is very imperfect as well, but it's better than tonnage for the exact reason that you laid out, where both of those sets are probably equally stimulative. And again, you made them match up. What if you did a set of six at 20 pounds? It'd be 120 pounds of tonnage volume load. If all three sets were to failure, I'd say all three are stimulative. It's when you get to sets that are like require north of 30 reps to achieve failure that represents a load that is so low, it's probably not fully taxing the high threshold motor units and really pushing those the fibers that really have the highest growth potential to failure or close to failure. Or if you're doing like sets of one, that tends to not give you the best bang for your buck in terms of stimulus. But within the, you know, air quote hypertrophy rep range, which I'm starting to realize is just not really a thing, you know, maybe it's more a thing on the very, very light end, but even sets of two and three and four can grow muscle if you do enough hard sets of them. Next question. Any tips to take in mind for a healthy pregnancy? Just found out I'm pregnant and want a strong foundation. Currently work out four times a week. Yeah, there's quite a bit. I would reference two podcasts that I did with Dr. Aaliyah. She is a pelvic floor physio up in Canada, and Brianna Battles, who's a prenatal, postnatal specialist. She's wonderful. I would follow both of them. They're fantastic. Thinking of how much do I want to regurgitate those podcasts here. I think continuing to do a lot of the healthy, you know, there's so much to unpack here. I'm going to refer you to those podcasts. I'm not going to go too much into them. I'd say if you're already working out 4 days a week, that's fantastic. I wouldn't dramatically increase the work that you're doing from an intensity or volume perspective. I wouldn't necessarily try and be in a calorie deficit. I would focus on, you know, general health foundational stuff, lifting, walking, getting out in the sunshine, you know, eating a varied nutritious diet. There are going to be some specific nutrients that you may want to focus on, most of them covered by your prenatal. And then there's a whole host of meeting yourself where you're at this season in life. And so you had said, hey, you know, any tips to take into mind for a healthy pregnancy? I have a feeling you're asking that from a physical perspective, like things you can do to be physically healthy. Man, do I think it's really important to deal with the mental side too, because there are going to be days that you can't do what you want to do or what you plan to do. There are going to be days that you eat more food than you planned, that you're craving something, you know. Man, Jenna, I'll never forget. Jenna looked at me and it was like, I don't know, 10:45 in the morning. She's like, Jordan? I was like, what? She's like, I need fried rice. And I was like, okay, well, we can order, you know, Chinese later, like, no problem. She's like, no, I need it now. And I was like, what? She's like, I just ordered it. It's coming now. I was like, okay, like, that's pregnancy, you know, like, that's going to happen sometimes. So I would refer you to those podcasts, but a whole lot of please, please, please focus on health. This might not be the time for epic PRs, and it's probably not the time for fat loss. Additionally, is it okay to have sugar in moderation in pregnancy? Yeah, so you're obviously going to do some gestational diabetes testing, and so I would make sure you just follow the guidelines from whatever that the results are of that test. The truth is, I wouldn't dramatically change your perspective on this. Whatever's going to come out of my mouth next is what I would recommend for basically everyone eating a diet that is the amount of calories that are required for you at this time, which, depending on where you are in pregnancy, is probably more than you were eating before. High in plant micronutrient dense fruits and vegetables, high in protein, high in healthy mono and polyunsaturated fats, not too many saturated fats. Take your prenatal. And so I, is it okay to have sugar in moderation in pregnancy? Absolutely. Is there a unique physiological state where if you're over consuming simple sugars by a ton that have a slight different physiological outcome here? Yeah. But not so much that I'd panic if you have any sugar at all. I would focus on what I just said, which is eating in the way that you would hopefully be eating regularly anyway, you know, which is not too much added sugar in the diet, but not worrying about sugar found in, you know, little added sugar is okay. And sugar, natural sugar found in foods, totally fine. When I say natural sugars in foods, totally fine, not because that sugar is different, but because eating foods that happen to have sugar in them, like fruits, vegetables, plant foods, basically, the whole food matrix is a huge net positive that I wouldn't be worried about their sugar content. Next question. Is doing my strength training on Life Fitness machines helpful as well, or do I have to use free weights? Thanks. Yes, it is absolutely helpful. Machines, I will say that, I'll tell you this right now. Machines, in many ways, are better than free weights. But free weights have their advantages too. It's not the case that one is always better than the other, but you'd probably have an easier time saying that for muscle growth, machines on average are better. But, you know, if I really was going to argue against myself, I think we'd get to a point where nobody would win and we'd say, you know what, both are probably part of the best program. But if you're not doing any free weights, can you still build muscle, be strong, be healthy, improve bone density, improve quality of life, metabolic health? Absolutely. Are there some exercises that maybe are really practical with free weights? Yeah, totally. Convenient with free weights? Yeah, totally. But I don't think you need to sweat if you're not using any free weights. But I would look at your program and kind of scratch my head if it doesn't have any free weights, because I'd be wondering how you'd be doing some movements. especially if you're restricted to just Life Fitness machines, which can be great. By the way, some of them are great. Some of them are dog shit, frankly, but some of them are great, yeah. Super tight slash sore inner thigh on one leg, especially on lower body days. I'm in the gym group and form videos I said are okayed by you. What to do about it? Sometimes it's hard to stand up after sitting and I have to hobble. I'm only 43. Here's the deal. If this soreness is not overlapping into another workout where you have to use those muscles to a degree in which it is inhibiting your ability to perform, then I don't care about it. Now, I don't mean it that way. That comes out weird, obviously, but then it's not worth worrying about. If you're doing leg days and you're finding that your adductors are mega sore, but then I tell you, okay, but are you progressing on your lifts over time? You're like, yeah. Then that's an amount of soreness that we don't worry about. Like, the question I would ask you is, are you so sore that it is either inhibiting your ability to live your everyday life or it's overlapping into a subsequent leg workout so much so that it is negatively impacting your performance and inhibiting you from progressing? Now, when most people take that context on board, they realize that the soreness that they have is no problem. And frankly, probably a good sign that they're training hard. So I'm not sure. I would want to know if that soreness is above that threshold, let's say. Wow, baby girl's really taking this nap. I guess we got a few more here. Let me see if... My phone's going to die. I'm on 6%. So we might just go till it dies here. If your wife, here we go. If your wife wanted to turn the house temperature down because she's constantly hot, would you do that? Meaning you'd freeze. Now, this is a bad question for me because I am the hot one. I could live with the house in the 50s. You know, I'd be fine. You know, I'm the one who wants to be in an ice box 24/7. But if we flipped that, and what if she wanted the heat up? Damn. You know, it's a tough one. It's like one of the most important parts of a good relationship is making sure you guys have very similar temperature prep. No, I'm just kidding. I would do it, of course. I mean, I would probably get a, if she wanted to jack the temperature up, the only time I'd have when I say a problem with that would be the only time I would want to fix that is when we go to sleep. I think if she was like, it's funny, my parents will come stay with us, or Jenna's parents, and just like older people they just tend to be colder on average. And so they're always cold and they want the temperature at like 73 or something when they go to sleep. To me, that's a friggin' sauna. So, you know, we'll crank open the windows. I know that that's terrible for energy use, but they need to stay warm and I can't sleep if it's 73. So, yeah. Next question, favorite books you've read, not necessarily health and fitness. I read a lot of books back in the day. I've been off the book game. Like the more self-development stuff. Some books that jump to mind are Motivational Interviewing. Motivational Interviewing in Health and Fitness is Motivational Interviewing is a general book about the motivational interviewing tactics. And then they have like kind of like a spin-off, like like an industry-specific one that says Motivational Interviewing in Health and Fitness. It's the funny part about that is that like the examples that they give in the book, they're like, they go through basically motivational interviewing is a behavior change technique. It's about, you know, asking a lot of open-ended questions, a lot of reflecting, I noticed the first time I had therapy that she motivational interviewed the shit out of me. And I recommend this book to everybody who works with patients or clients. But yeah, it's funny. In the health and fitness book, the examples they give are so dated. It's like, I almost don't want people to read the health and fitness one because the examples they give are just like so scientifically inaccurate. But whatever, it's still like a good, it reframes the book into a clinical setting of like working with a patient or client, which is nice. Other books are I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. I'm not a big finance guy. I know that there's like a lot of fitness influencers who dabble in there. You know, they play the stock market. They're big on like, you know, they get into like financial advice. That's not me at all. But Ramit's book represents a philosophy that really clicked for me. Essentially, it's about, you know, spending more on stuff you really care about and saving ruthlessly on stuff you don't care about. Stop overspending on stuff that doesn't really make you happy and double, triple, quadruple spend on stuff that does make you happy. And an example for me is like having a really nice home gym that really isn't cost effective, but makes me incredibly happy. But then, you know, not, you know, buying a brand new car every 3 years, you know, I don't give a shit about cars. I just want a car that, you know, gets me from point A to point B. That's an example of that philosophy, let's say. Other books that jump to mind. You know, normally I'm doing this podcast in my office and my bookshelf is right behind me, so I'd have a better answer for you. I read a lot of fiction. I read all the Blake Crouch books recently. I really much prefer reading fiction these days. I find that nonfiction books are almost an oxymoron sometimes. You know, you buy a new health and nutrition book and it just, most of them are crap. I did buy Dr. Id's book recently, Saturated Facts. I highly recommend, very good book. Actually, halfway through listening to it right now. Cool. Next question. Really enjoy your and appreciate your fitness/health approach to life these days. How you talk about mindset, relationship to food and body, and all that good stuff. How you make us question our goals. I love it that your account isn't all about losing fat and growing muscle. I really appreciate you. Wow, that's super nice. We are going to end on that note. I really appreciate that. I will say that that's not how I've always been, and I think that that's certainly something that has changed about my relationship with food and body over the last, you know, that's changed over the last decade or so. And so I really do appreciate that. I really, you know, I want people to use health and fitness to live their most fulfilling life, right? I think of health and fitness as a means, not an end, right? A lot of people are like, I want to get jacked. And I'm like, why? They're like, so I can be jacked. Like, that's an end. You think that being jacked is an end. I think of it as a means, not being jacked per se, but like being healthy. It's like, you should be asking yourself, if I say you want to be fit so that you can blank, you should have an answer to that question, all right? I want to improve my health and fitness so that I can do blank or be blank or, you know, do this activity or be around for longer or do this with my kids or my grandkids. Or there should be being healthy is a means to living a really wonderful life. It's not necessarily like being shredded for shredded's sake, let's say. So I'll leave it on that. Thank you guys. It's been already way longer than I had hoped, but it is what it is. Have a good one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.